All right, it's 4:15. Let's get started. This is Accurate Communication. Just a sentence of, or two of introduction here. I'm Kyle Staltzfus. And when I'm not currently studying church history and theology, which takes most of my time right now, I'm working at Faith Builders and also being a father and a husband at the same time. So I find myself stretched a bit right now. The stretching is a good thing. Let's pray together, and then we will push right into accurate communication. Let's pray. Father, you've made us with the ability of language, and it means so much to us. Without language, we could do very little. Our world would be totally different, and the real riches that you've gifted us with as humans would just be, they'd escape us. Thank you for language. Thank you that you've given us this great ability. Amen. To get us started, I'm going to list off three reasons why I think that you should develop accuracy in your written language, or spoken for that matter. Three reasons. The first reason is that specialized language is the foundation of learning a new trade. Trades are those things where you have abilities, you develop skills, you learn to solve problems. That's what trades are. And specialized language is the foundation of those. So in aviation, if you want to become a pilot, the flat moving panel is not a substitute for aileron or rudder. Would you be willing to fly with a pilot who didn't know the difference between the altimeter and the fuel gauge? Okay. Technical language. As teachers, working with a learning disabled student might plunge you into the Barton reading system, where you're going to be learning about the terms like dyslexia, or maybe the Orton-Gillingham influence that's present in your curriculum for helping that person with dyslexia. It's important. As theologians, the ability to distinguish between pre- and post-lapsarian views of human formation might give you a bit more firepower when you're talking about God's distribution of salvation. It might just help you distinguish whether you are a Calvinist or not. Okay? Specialized language is the foundation of learning a new trade. A second reason. The discriminating power of specialized or accurate language has more value than just utility. Let me tease that out. Our ability to discern things, to distinguish them from one another, is foundational to our perception. An example of that, and this one I find really interesting. The British Prime Minister, William Gladstone, some years ago, he was also a scholar of Homer. For those of you just breaking in, there's handouts up here. I'll just put them right over to you. If anybody else comes in, you were late, please distribute them. So the British Prime Minister, William Gladstone, he was a scholar of Homer, and he conducted an exhaustive study of every reference of color in Homer's The Odyssey, and also The Iliad. And he found something kind of startling. There's no reference in either one of those books to the word, or to the color, blue. No reference to the color blue. And there's a broader pattern to this, he discovered, in all literature of that era, across all cultures, in fact. Words for colors tend to appear in stages, and blue always comes last. So you wonder, how do they describe things that we see as blue? The sky is not, for them, blue. The sea is wine dark, just like the color of oxen. Now, I might be overstating this, but what's so fascinating about this is that you cannot experience what you cannot describe. You cannot conceive what you have no category for. And if you don't believe me, just ask any baby, right? Life before language is a tangle of disordered sensations and response. It's a world of textures, shapes, smells, sounds. They invite no questions, and they give no ground for furnishing response without language. There is happiness, certainly, in this world without language, but a very small capacity for directed experience. And I'm asserting what I'm arguing here is language is every bit that important. Without language, you can neither conceive nor direct your experience. So language allows us to describe the world. It allows us to describe systems of thought, our own experiences, and allows other people to be invited into them. We can connect with other people with language, and they experience, even just for a moment, something of what it is that we're experiencing it. They participate in our own reality. The more accuracy and precision we offer, the more richly we can experience our own worlds, and the more likely it is that other people can participate in the richness of our own perceptions. Okay? Just argued the second point, discriminating of thing from thing has more value than just utility. A third reason, and this one deserves just a small illustration. In communication theory, it's pretty simple. There's two basic components of communication. There's a sender. And there's a receiver. Okay, make this much more complicated. This is a good place to start. And the reality is that as a sender, this is your language. This is the pool of resources you have as a communicator to pull from. And it's, when you start off, fairly empty. I'm just saying that with language, we're not born knowing it. Okay? And this is your receiver's language, likewise. You're not born knowing language. You have to learn it. You have to learn language. And there's something that's amazing about us as humans is we are pre-wired to respond to language. However, you have to learn it. And each generation has to learn language anew. Okay? Because of that, because we have to learn language and each generation learns it new, we do not all learn to use words in the same way. And consequent to that, the meaning of language is therefore dynamic. It changes with transmission. Accurate communication is what accounts for that drift in language. It helps us to realize that we as senders bring our own meanings. Receivers may use the same word a little bit differently. I'm getting ahead of myself, I think. The second challenge, and related to the first, that we're not born just knowing language, you have to learn it. The second challenge of human language is this. Every word or phrase we express is a creative act. Okay? And that's simply because the language that we use to describe and convey our experiences is uniquely ours. Because our experiences are different from those of our audience. And even though we have things in common, there's a common grammar, a common syntax, the way we use words does, in some ways at least, belong to us. The language that other people hear are receivers, what they understand is they're a little bit different. So when we're trying to communicate with people in written language, we have to bring our own experiences and preconceptions to our language in a way that negotiates with what our receivers are actually hearing. Okay? It's not just a one-way street. You have to receive feedback. You have to incorporate that. You have to be responsive to what it is your receivers are actually hearing. And that's what accurate communication does. It's responsive. It's two-way. When I'm saying that we're talking about accuracy, you're compensating for some of the difficulty of transmission and the differences of meaning that we assign language. Finally, third, human language is challenging because, and you've heard this coming through already probably, that even if two people use the same word, they may interpret that word differently. And here I'm just going to reinforce that many communication errors are on the receiving end. Right? The author, the writer may intend to say something, it may be clear in their minds, however, what's received is something that's very different than that. So to communicate accurately must allow for that, must allow for the slippage that happens. This means you have to be charactered as a sender. You have to be willing to receive feedback, even when it hurts. You have to receive with humility and take the needs of your receiver into account, not just your own as a sender. A little bit more broadly, though, with these challenges of human language, with the unique meaning we all bring to it, it's no wonder that people miss each other, especially with written communication, when all these other cues we rely on, with spoken language, when all of those are taken away and all we have is written word in front of us, it's no wonder that sometimes we make mistakes, sometimes we miss each other. But that's not quite the point. The point is that accurate communication understands and at least tries to compensate for the challenges of human language. And this only gives us more reason to pay attention to the language that we use when we're writing. That's what I mean by accuracy. What does this mean? Okay. Well, we'll get specific here. I mean that carefully chosen words make your written message more intelligible, more interesting, and more memorable. Written language with poor and inaccurate word choice, on the other hand, makes your communication vague, boring, confusing, a little worse, possibly offensive, or just plain forgotten. Okay. So now I've given, again, three reasons for us to develop our ability as accurate communicators. First, it's necessary for learning a trade. One good reason, if you want to learn something new, if you want to do new things, you're going to learn new language. Second, accurate language alters our perception of the world. The richer our vocabulary, the richer our experience of the world. And third, accurate communication helps us to overcome some of the foibles of human language. That's my argument. Having said that, what I want to do next and spend the balance of our time with here is to talk about ways to both deploy and develop precise, concrete, and accessible language. As a result, I hope for your language and your writing to be more memorable, interesting, and intelligible. First of all, I suggest that you use specific language. I mean here language that is concrete. It's accurate. It's not so unfamiliar to your audience that it's just jargon. Or, on the other side of it, it's not so obtuse that they consider it vulgar. And vulgarity is something that's a little bit more broad than just the nasty or profane, okay? And it needs to be specific and concrete. Specific language. Why is it important? Well, the first words we tend to pick when we're trying to describe something or to describe our thoughts, the first words we pick tend to be general, they tend to be abstract, they tend to be imprecise. This makes the listener choose from many possible images rather than the one that you intend to convey. The more they are called to provide their own image, the more likely it is that they're going to see meanings that are different than ours. And It's going to be unintelligible to them. Precise language clarifies meaning by narrowing from very broad and general categories to a particular item or a particular group. It's specific, moving from things like games of skill. Now here's an example, games of skill, and from there to group games, board games, strategy games, Settlers of Catan. You see the movement, general, vague, abstract, to particular and precise. Another quality of specific language is its concreteness. Concrete language appeals to the senses. You can hear it, you can see it, smell it, taste or touch what has been described. Concrete language would move from house to middle class, single level ranch, a white ranch house with green shrubbery, red shutters, and a steel roof. Okay, you saw the movement from abstract to concrete. Let's work at this one a little bit. What I'd like to do is I'll give you a chance to work at this yourself. We'll just kind of shout it out or work at it. I'm going to put up a picture for us, and we're going to have to move on a continuum from vague to precise, from abstract to concrete. We're going to try to fill in as many details along the way on that continuum from vague over to precise as we possibly can. So, this is, I don't want to identify it at all. I'm going to pollute this. Well, hang on a second. That was pretty precise right away. Let me get this up. What I want to do is start off as vague as we can and move to precise and concrete. Okay? So, let me set this up here. It might not be totally visible. Start us off here as vague as you possibly can.
Machine.
Oh, that's kind of specific.
Object.
Object.
Thing with thing. Wings.
Oh, that's getting more specific. Thing. Okay. Somebody said thing with wings. Machine kind of fits somewhere in here.
Vehicle.
Vehicle. Probably more precise. There's a lot of things with wings that are not vehicles, right? I can spell it. We can work here a little bit longer.
Motorized machine.
Motorized machine. That's good. That's about vehicle. Okay, keep us moving along here.
Mode of transportation.
Mode of transportation. Okay, it's kind of along with vehicle, I think. Take us one step further this way.
Everybody's scared of airplane.
The only ones, I think it's about time for airplane. Okay, yes, it's an airplane. Tell me more about it. Single engine. Okay. I hear people struggling with names. That's good. What kind of single engine airplane?
It's a light passenger craft.
Light passenger. That's almost what the FAA would say. Uh-huh. Very good. No pilots.
Puddle hopper.
Puddle hopper. that's going the wrong way. I guess I'll just have to tell you about this one a little bit. Well, before I do that, let me open up another category. If we're talking in terms of these precise technical terms, how about in terms of like emotional language? Can you move us along using experiential language to describe what this might represent? In other words, What does that mean to you?
Speed.
Speed. Okay.
Excitement.
Excitement.
Thrill.
Yes. How specific can you get? Work your vocabulary here.
Crash.
No. I put that on your speed. Anything else?
Exhilarating.
Nice word. Yes. That melody. You see the point. As we continue to move along, what I might also suggest as we get more and more precise is that this is a single engine, which is identified, internal combustion, prop-driven aircraft. Okay, let's go another notch. This is a blue and white Cherokee 140. It's not a Cessna, it's a Piper, right? It's got a low wing. It's a blue and white Cherokee 140. Its call sign is 1786 Tango. However, there's a whole wealth of language that I can begin to access as the sender because this is the aircraft that I trained in. And suddenly there's this explosion in my mind of sense, of sensations, of fear, yes, that goes with it, the nervousness. And I also know the destiny of this aircraft. It wasn't my own fault, but another student at the same school took it into a line of trees, trying to show off to his girlfriend. She wasn't impressed. Neither was the aircraft. But to drive the point home again, there's a movement that we have, a continuum that moves from vague and abstract to concrete and specific. Accurate language is what brings others along into the experiences that ultimately I, as a sender, can only convey, because this is a craft that I actually have a history with. Okay. How, then, do we develop accurate language? Most of what I've been doing now is trying to convince you that you should use accurate language and that there's a continuum here. How do we do this? The first suggestion I have is to leverage the vocabulary you already have. Access the vocabulary you have. I suppose I was trying to describe my morning encounters with my neighbor's Cocker Spaniels. I might journal as I'm processing the day later, small dogs are awful. But that's too vague. That's too reproachful. So I brainstorm. I don't usually brainstorm when I'm journaling, but let's suppose I did. I brainstorm. Small dogs are frustrating. They're bothersome. They're annoying. They're caustic. These convey different meanings. So I suggest that you bring precise language into your writing through rehearsal and brainstorming. Make those precise words that you identify through your brainstorming key words in your writing and return to them frequently. They're going to anchor whatever article it is you're composing, whatever writing project you have. Identify the critical words and then return to them with some frequently. Let them structure your writing. Precise language, however, ought not to be pretentious or pompous. So I'm saying access the vocabulary you have first. And pretentious and pompous words tend not to be specific or concrete. They make the writing stilted or worse, irrelevant to the audience. So writing with precision and concreteness, right, does not need to be obscure. So as a rule, use a difficult word only when you believe it is the best word for your audience, for the specific context that you're writing into. You wanted a more precise or specific word than building. Using familiarity as your guide, you may select house, apartment, high-rise, or skyscraper. However, you would want to avoid edifice. It is no more precise or specific. It's just obscure and impressive. More examples. Clothing could be a sufficient word, could be specific enough if you're describing articles which people wear. Apparel is probably no more specific. Bury, to bury somebody, may be adequate instead of inter. Avoid might be sufficient. Eschew sounds kind of excessive. Beauty is a robust concept. Paltritude isn't particularly helpful. So, access the vocabulary you have and make it useful. Second, after you've accessed the vocabulary you have, explore a larger vocabulary. Become unsatisfied with sloppiness. Stick to the precise meaning of words and find words which convey the meaning that you actually have in mind. Second way to explore a larger vocabulary is to saturate yourself with stretching material. Always go beyond one level of what it is you're actually able to comprehend. Well, sure, it's uncomfortable, but that's what it's there for, is to stretch your ability and become more skilled with precision. Don't jump past the words that you don't understand as you read. Attend closely to talented writers and their use of language. Third, become a student of words. Explore the meaning behind the meaning. This is the discipline of etymology, not to be confused with entomology. Etymology. Fourth, develop a dictionary habit. And this might go with number two. As you're reading material that's stretching your ability to comprehend, note the words that you don't understand and pursue them. Okay. Fifth, this is very practical and a little bit vulnerable, practice oral editing. Analyze and improve your word choice as you practice speaking with clarity and precision aloud. That transfers fairly well into written material as well. Five ways there, again, to explore a larger vocabulary. However, I encourage you, as you're exploring a larger vocabulary, to, when you write, choose familiar terms. And you feel this going back and forth, back and forth. This is somewhat how my mind works, as a pendulum. You want to access the vocabulary you have. You want to explore a larger vocabulary. But as you do, choose familiar words. And here I'm just going to give you an example. This is from Judith Butler, an award-winning professor of rhetoric and comparative literature at Berkeley. She wrote in the academic journal Diacritics this masterpiece, which I will read for you. It is one sentence. The move from a structuralist account in which capital is understood to structure social relations in relatively homodulous ways hegemony in which power relations are subject to repetition, convergence, and rearticulation brought the question of temporality into the thinking of structure and marked a shift from a form of Althusserian theory that takes structural totalities as theoretical objects to one in which the insights into the contingent possibility of structure inaugurate a renewed conception of hegemony as bound up with the contingent sites and strategies of the rearticulation of power. You get it? Okay, that's a 94-word sentence. And to ask what that means misses the point. The sentence beats the reader into submission and instructs them that they are in the presence of a deep and great mind. When readers are baffled by phrases like take structural totalities as theoretical objects, they assume it is because of their ignorance, but most likely the author is just showing off, elevating a trivial subject, or trying to be profound or moving by borrowing sources or borrowing resources from sources that actually are. Accuracy has nothing to do with language like that. So, avoid jargon. And if that didn't convince you, I don't know. What's that?
What you read, 94 words, is there a simple sentence for that?
I'd have to work on that. I don't know.
They didn't know what they were saying, I don't think.
They may not have. When you get into writing that's that obscure, you kind of get the sense they might be lost themselves. That's how you get a PhD. I'm sorry. That was rude. It's how you get tenure. So, avoid jargon. Jargon is unique technical terminology of a trade or a profession that's not understood by outsiders. I said trade language is important, right? The language that people in the trade learn over time and accumulate has meaning. It's specific. It means something to them. It's less helpful to people outside of that trade. So bear that in mind. You want to avoid jargon. So jargon, as it's being developed in a specific trade, is appropriate to specific audiences, people within the trade who may understand what totality of objects actually means. However, be mindful, again, of your audience. Be mindful of the situation you're writing into and use language which is appropriate to them. That's what accuracy means, not just being grandiose. Speak to the audience and avoid jargon. On the other hand, however, avoid slang. Slang is just non-standard informal vocabulary that's loaded with meaning by your own subculture or social group. But outside of that, it has very little meaning, kind of a little bit like jargon, but it's non-standard and informal. Slang is not necessarily coarse. It has a specific meaning, like jargon, but the meaning is not the standard meaning. And here, I beg you to remember that vulgarity is not just swearing. This is kind of a parenthetical thing. I'll let it dangle. Vulgarity is not just swearing. It is any description which strips an object of significance and meaning. Earth is shot through with sacredness. The vulgar, the base, slang, abases the sacredness. So, to avoid slang, consider your generation, your social group. Remember that the language that you adopt, the language you use, will affect your perceptions and the perceptions of your readers. Language, it's more than just a limp medium that we can just sling around. It actually adjusts how we perceive and experience the world. So, I'll be specific. Avoid slang. Avoid sayings like, how random is that? Go ahead and declare it. If it indeed was random, say it was random. Don't ask it and only assign the value of randomness to things which actually are random. The dog wants out. The dog wants what? Out. Just say, the dog wants to go outside. Or hand it a copy of Out magazine, if that's what he actually wants. The dog wants out. That really makes sense. It really does. Not how appropriate. Please. That really makes sense. It really does. Needless, non-descriptive adjectives clutter up speech without an emphasis on clarity. without adding any emphasis or clarity. At best, these needless words are just redundant. At worst, they make a writer appear unreliable. So avoid unnecessary descriptives. Now I'm going to push a little bit harder. This is really unique. Unique is a superlative. Unique means one of a kind, not different or unusual. There is only one of a unique item. There are not degrees of uniqueness. There's not a continuum to uniqueness. There's not very one of a kind or pretty much one of a kindish. Right? I could care less. Now, what is meant by this is the exact opposite. I could not care less. That's slang. How about, it literally knocked my socks off. Literally is under a lot of attack these days. Getting hit by a car will literally knock your socks off. Diving headfirst off a 30-foot bridge may literally knock your socks off. A shocking bit of gossip does not knock your socks off. A last one. I'm not a happy camper. Wouldn't it just be more efficient if you would tell me what you are rather than what you are not? And all that has been accomplished by a statement like that is the elimination of one of the innumerable nouns that you could possibly be, which is really extremely abstract if you stop and think about it. If you are to dump coffee on my head, I should say, I am angry, not I am an unprofitable bake sale, or I am an internal combustion engine running a bit lean. Which has the same meaning as not a happy camper. That is slang. So, as you consider your generation, also consider your subculture. What alternative meanings are brought to bear when we talk about family, church, or more specifically about marriage, child raising, church leadership, and discipline? Just bear in mind that the meaning you may have in mind as a sender may be different than what your receivers are actually hearing. Okay? And last, consider your audience. As you're thinking about slang, consider your audience. Communicate the non-standard meaning of your words with illustration, fresh wording, and clear definition, because our use of slang is inevitable. Our use of language is local. And because of that, we can make up for some of the differences of slang, of informal use of language, by illustrating it. Now, let's get a little more practical. I encourage you to write vividly. Use language that's full of life. Use language that has energy, intensity, and charisma. This is the difference between, in an article I wrote a little while ago, it's the difference between, we should remember that simplicity is an old problem. True enough. Or, on the other end, if you want to add a little bit more life, we do well to remember that the audience addressed by Jesus struggled to give him undivided focus even without smartphones. They divided their loyalty between family responsibilities, economic uncertainty, and worry. These are familiar concerns. As we deal with technology, then, we can be assured that we are only addressing old and tired problems with very old solutions. Okay? Took a little bit longer to say it, but I think it conveyed the meaning with more precision and accuracy. So write vividly. Second, as you write vividly, engage the senses. Use language that appeals to the senses of sight, of hearing, taste, smell, feeling. You do this by using vivid sensory language, and that begins with vivid sensory experience yourself. So have you felt the bite of the wind? Have you felt the sting of freezing rain? Have you walked outside during a snowstorm? Have you spent your money on experiences that enhance your own vocabulary and give you a wealth of experiences to actually draw from. Use sensory language. And I'm suggesting that you cultivate your own ability by actually having those experiences that aliven your own senses. As you write vividly, third, provide details and examples. Examples like, Eric is very bold. Okay, that's a true statement. How is Eric bold? Eric is bold. He ordered coffee at Starbucks and then asked for a refill. Okay, I made Eric come alive a little bit more there. As you write vividly, finally, use figures and structures of speech. Use figures and structures of speech. Figures of language make comparisons between things that are not obviously alike, and they help the listener to visualize and internalize what it is you're writing. Structures of language combine ideas in memorable ways. Okay? I'm going to run us through then a list of examples of what I mean by structures of language, figures and structures of speech. I'm going to first name it, and then I'm going to identify it or define, and I'll give some illustrations. So a first structure, and these may be familiar to some of you, is simile. Simile. Simile is direct comparison between two unlike things. Walks like a duck. Simile. Life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. Teaching children is like trying to keep 25 corks under the water at the same time. Simile. Next, metaphor. Metaphor is simply implied comparison without using like or as. Metaphor could be, or a metaphor is naming a problem vehicle, a lemon. It's not actually a lemon, but it's a metaphor, a lemon. A leaky roof is a sieve. It's not literally a sieve, but that helps us to understand through metaphor. Use, third, a structure of analogy. Analogy you can think of as extended metaphor. It's metaphor that stretches out over time. A story can be developed to become a brief metaphor. At its most basic, a family member who is a black sheep in the barnyard, well, that's a metaphor. Is a metaphor. However, when you describe a scenario which illustrates how it is, so Jesus' parables, which illustrates that you've made an analogy, okay? You've taken that metaphor and you've stretched it out. You've made a story, that's analogy. Analogy is really helpful when you're trying to illustrate similarities between a complex subject and one that is familiar. Jesus was a master at using analogy. This might apply a little bit more to spoken language. I'd also encourage you to use alliteration. Alliteration is repetition of consonant sounds at the beginning of words. A little bit less effective when you're writing right, but still people do tend to pick it up. Things like military madness destroys peace and prosperity, or precarious ponderings of princes, which sometimes leads to military madness, right? Another structure. We talked about alliteration. Also think about assonance. That's the repetition of vowel sounds rather than consonant sounds in a phrase. How now, brown cow? Third world poverty is, in fact, a serious problem. I ask you to act now. Okay? Some assonance. That's A-S-S-O-N-A-N-C-E. A-S-S-O-N-A-N-C-E. another category, structures of speech. This isn't so much a structure, I suppose. Let's see if we can get this out. I always struggle. Onomatopoeia. Just use it. This is the use of words that sound like what they stand for. Buzz, hiss, crack, pop. Add some liveliness. Use repetition. This is the restating of words, phrases, or sentences for emphasis. Fairly straightforward. A good example of this, if you wanted to look at it, was Martin Luther King's speech, "I Have a Dream." Lots of repetition, very effective. A last structure, this one I'd love to see a little bit more use of, is the use of couplets or antithesis. Very old structure, still very effective, I think. This is when you combine contrasting ideas into one sentence. A couplet might be, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." Or, "One small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind." Simple, powerful. Or, to go way back to the 2nd century, the Bishop of Lyon, Irenaeus, "The glory of God is a living human being, and the life of the human being is in beholding the image of God." You could take that and work with that for a long time, right? It's a couplet. It identifies something with the parameters of where you're going to be thinking. So in conclusion, I have emphasized the importance of accurate language. Accurate language, first of all, allows us to enter new trades. Second, it's not just a luxury. It changes how we see the world. It alters our perception. Third, it helps us to overcome some of the challenges of human communication. So, because of that, use specific language. Well, how do you do that? Access the vocabulary you have. Explore larger vocabulary. Choose familiar words. And write vividly. I'm just going to leave you with one further reason to write, to speak with accuracy. And that's this. Our world is full of ambiguity. It's full of generalization. It's full of muddy-headedness. And we're that much more than impoverished because of it. So, let's clear the air and let's write clearly. We've got just a couple minutes. I'll pray then for supper, but I wonder if there's any questions, any response.
Please. In Christian writing, is there such a thing as religious jargon? Maybe jargon isn't quite the word for it, but words that a person assumes are that everybody understands, but they don't.
Mm-hmm. I think there's some workshops here on that. What do you say? Is there such a thing as religious jargon? Yeah, I think absolutely, yes. One of the challenges then is to take the jargon that's gotten stripped of its meaning and to bring it back alive again. You don't have to change the meaning, but it's lost some of its sense.
You could find ways to explore a larger vocabulary. Did you want to win this?
Absolutely. Five ways to explore a larger vocabulary. Here we go. First way, become unsatisfied with sloppiness. Motivation. Second way, saturate yourself with stretching material. Third, am I moving too fast? Okay. Become a student of words. That's etymology. Fourth, develop a dictionary habit. And fifth, practice oral editing.
Welcome. You use the terms precision and accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
How do you distinguish between those two words?
Good question. And I ought to be able to, right? If I'm speaking accurately. The way I'm using accuracy is a bit more general. So I'd welcome challenge, but I think of accurate as a more general category in which specific tends to fit. Okay? So accurate language is that broader category that helps us to think more generally about sender and receiver, about understanding our audience, and specific is more of a characteristic of language that actually... That's not good, that's circular. Specific language is just what satisfies the criteria of what we set out as accurate, okay? I'm not helping, am I? I'll just say it this way. I think accurate language is something I'm using more generally. Specific language is, I'm using more specifically. Also not helpful. This is that oral editing I'm talking about.
Might be somewhat like, yeah. Accuracy is like a big circle, and then there are all these little circles like specific and concrete and all. Mm-hmm. Accuracy covers a large area, maybe. That's just what I'm thinking.
That's a good way to visualize it, I think.
And then specific, but there are certain words, sentences perhaps, where specific would fit in better than accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
Depending what idea you're trying to portray or how you're trying to say.
That's helpful. Thank you. So concrete language may be a substitute for more specific language, depending what your audience actually needs. So if Jesus had been as specific as he could, he would have written a systematic theology. But because he didn't, and he didn't want to, he used a lot of analogies. He used a lot of concrete language to convey his meanings. I tend to think of the specific language as more leaning toward the technical end of the spectrum. Both are needed.
Also, accuracy is just the state of being correct. That 94-word sentence, we suppose, is correct.
Uh-huh.
But it's in some ways, it's not very specific. Maybe in another way, it is overly specific.
Uh-huh. But we're not sure.
Yeah.
So for us, it's inaccurate. Right? I'm fairly sure she had something in her head, though, so we'll give her that. Yes, go ahead.
I don't know if this is a question or a thought or what, or if it's going to stimulate more discussion, but our point here has been clear words, choosing words that are clear. What, before you do that, you have to be thinking clearly, right?
Hmm.
And maybe that's a whole other subject, but maybe words help us think. I'm not sure.
Hmm.
But thinking clearly is hard work. And if you're not thinking clearly, I don't care what kind of terminology you command, it's going to come out in the muddle.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking clearly is really hard work
for me. Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice? How do you develop as a clear thinker? Anybody else? It would be difficult to separate the two.
Thinking in terminology?
Yeah, you're going to need both.
Because we think in words.
Generally.
Or pictures.
Or pictures. They kind of combine.
Going back to language building, one thing you can do is have some handy place, a notebook or something, to write words in.
Mm-hmm.
They will stick a little better than if you... Even if you go to a dictionary and read something, if you actually write it down, I do that some. And another thing is, if you find a word, it's a new word for you, go ahead and have the discipline of using it over the next several days.
Mm-hmm.
Other people shouldn't know that you're putting it into your everyday speech, but it's a good discipline for yourself to just cement that vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's helpful.
Was it Mark Twain that said the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug? And another comment I had, how does the connotation and the denotation of a word fit into all of this? You have any comment on that?
Oh, my. You're going to have to expand that a little bit. Connotation and annotation.
Connotation and denotation.
Denotation.
You know, it's the precise meaning of the word mm-hmm. versus the emotion or the personality of the word.
Mm-hmm.
How does that fit into this whole?
Doesn't that word get in subcultures? Have different words have different feels. I mean, they might overlap, mm-hmm. but the feeling you get on this one sways this way, and the feeling you get on this one sways that way, even if they mean the same thing. But the complication of that is that varies depending on your subculture.
Right. So at least that's a call to a lot of sensitivity.
I think so, yeah.
An openness to feedback.
Can't take something to forth and say it
It's quite true.
He's a charismatic preacher could mean two entirely different things.
Very well could. Yes, go ahead.
Sort of another field that branches off of that. Do you have any thoughts on intentionally maybe shifting the meaning of what you say by using loaded language, mm-hmm. choosing connotation to imply something that you wouldn't want to say because you don't think you can defend it? Is that something that should be completely avoided and not dabbled in at all?
Mm-hmm. The question of rhetoric. I'd be careful. What's the intention behind that? And the way I tend to discern my own loaded use of language is if it's adding additional meaning to that word and not abasing the word or the concept or stripping meaning away, which I've basically said that's vulgarity to do that. If it's adding meaning and clarifying and affirming, you might consider it. But if it's taking meaning away or just taking a jab or stripping sense away, I couldn't justify it. Does that connect? Somewhat.
Probably the making jab things as much about sneaking as anything.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's okay to make a point to degrade other people. That starts to march into territory that I'd like to stay clear of myself. Not necessarily degrade, but just agitate.
A sharp point turns into a jab.
Yeah. Take some care. That's all I can say. Be ready for some feedback, too. Okay. You're dismissed.